Accession number 12175, row 3.
Saying Scotch death policy,
as in Russia, about I suppose 2 weeks later the real attack came through and we moved off, and of course left all our tents and equipment and everything there, and the Germans did take it over. So at least they didn't get hold of our tent.
Was there an atmosphere of real panic when the Germans were attacking in the summer of 1942?
Well, we used to, on the edge of the airfields, right on the edge of the coastal road, and our latrines were right on the edge of the road, so we used to sacking round them. So when we went there in the morning to have our constitutional, we used to watch the traffic going back and forth. And then one morning we found a tremendous amount of activity with lorries and all kinds of transports, all going back at very high speed towards Alexandria. So we knew then that something was going on. But communications weren't all that good with the army. We weren't liaising with the army because our job was to protect the convoys going to Tobruk, as I said. But there were two other squadrons, the Swordfish Squadron, which were doing night bombing ahead of the army. When the army was advancing, and I think a Hurricane squadron also at another different airfield, which was used for land strafing, and they were under the army control. The army said we want such and such a target attacked, and they used to do that, but we weren't supposed to do that at all. We did it just for something to do occasionally, because in fact we never came across any German aircraft over these convoys at all.
How did you feel about flying the Martlet?
It had a very narrow undercarriage and was liable to swing. You had to be rather careful landing it because it was apt to ground loop, but I didn't have any accidents. I don't remember anybody having any accidents.
Which did you prefer, flying the Walrus or the Martlet?
Oh, it's a completely different type of aircraft, so much faster, and I was delighted to be flying a fighter. Just before Alamein, we were sent down to East Africa because at that time the Vichy French were making trouble, and it was decided to move them out of Madagascar and make landings there. And so they sent us down by air, and the troops went by sea to Mombasa to act as a reserve squadron for the Illustrious. And in fact, as so happened, the Vichy French packed up in about a week, and so we were not required, and we stayed in Nairobi for the next 4 or 5 months. And we thought everybody had forgotten about us because we had a marvelous time. hospitality of the local farmers was terrific. And we used to go and spend weekends on farms and go fishing and big game hunting and really had the most marvelous time. We used to fly over Kilimanjaro and take photographs of formation photographs and that kind of thing. And we trained from about 6 o'clock in the morning until about midday, because after that it was very, very bumpy. And we were at an airfield called Nairobi West, and on the edge of this airfield they had a pride of lambs with cubs and everything right on the edge of the airfield. We didn't go too near them. We could see them when we were coming in and out landing. But of course, it was 5,000 feet up, so you were landing rather higher speed up there than at the ground level.
What happened to you after this period at Nairobi?
We took passage to Inilustris to come home. And we were hoping to go and visit Durban and Cape Town. We'd heard so much about the pretty girls that were there, but unfortunately we went right round to Freetown. And then when we got off Gibraltar, we had some albacores on board, and the captain said, "Has anybody flown an albacore before?" And I said, "Yes." So he said, "Right, you leave these 12 albacores and land them at Gibraltar." I think they were going to take them through to Malta, was the idea. Anyhow, we did that, and the ship went on home without me and another pilot from the 805 Squadron. And we came home about 2 weeks later in the Argus. We were one of the very early carriers. And when we got home, we found that the squadron had been split up and the pilots had been appointed to various other squadrons. And we were appointed to go to Washington, D.C., to captain, as he was, and Caspar John, and to liaise with the Americans and test aircraft which we were taking over. That's Avengers, Hellcats, Corsairs, all those aircraft which we were taking over at the time, and to see that the right modifications were put in, our own radios and crystals and all this kind of thing. And I did that for about 6 months, and I got rather fed up with it, and I, after a couple of months, and I used to go and see Caspar John on the first of the month and say, "Look, I think I want to get back into operations again. I'm not doing much good here." Oh, he said, "You're doing a great job. I want you to stay." And every month I used to go and see him, and he said, "Watch you again, big brother." I said, "Yes, sir. I want to get into operations again." I said, I think an attractive wren could do my job just as well as I can do it, because I wasn't doing a great deal of flying then. And eventually the day came, and I reported on the first of the month, and he said, I'm going to give you the next Corsair squadron. Go up to Brunswick."
So you preferred danger to boredom?
I wanted all my friends were in action somewhere or other, and I felt I was really doing nothing there. And I wanted to, you know, get back into the war, really. And much as I enjoyed being in Washington, I felt I was just getting useless. So then I went up to, before the squadron formed, I went up to Brunswick, Maine, and joined a squadron there, which was a training pilots, who'd been done their initial training at Pensacola, and training them in fighter tactics and so forth, deck landings, I did that for several months, and then on March the 1st I was promoted to acting lieutenant commander, and the CO of 1841 Corsair Squadron, also at Brunswick, Maine. We did our deck landings at the end of the training period. We did our deck landings at Norfolk, Virginia.
What did you think to flying the Corsair?
Well, I had flown it before, of course. I'd flown the very early ones, which we were taking over from the US Navy, who'd really decided that they were not suitable for landing on carriers because they had a very long nose, a radial engine nose, and they overheated if you didn't open the cowls. And opening the cowls all round gave you even less fission than you had before. So they decided that the Hellcat, which had much better forward vision, was the one they were going to use, and they gave us the Corsairs. And as it happened, we had no trouble landing the Corsairs on the deck, apart from what I can tell you in a moment. With my squadron, but the other squadrons that started had very little problem, and so later in that summer, the Americans decided to take more of the Corsairs and give us more of the Hellcats, which weren't as fast. You see, the Hellcat was about 30 or 40 knots slower than a Corsair. The Corsair was a very rugged aircraft, and you could really bounce it on the deck. The Seafires, on the other hand, were really not very suitable for carrier work. They were too flimsy.
These were the Spitfires.
Hmm. Yeah.
What about the personnel of 1841 squadron?
They were all about aged between 18 and 20, I suppose. All these people from Pensacola, and then I had one ex-petty officer pilot who was by then a lieutenant. He was my senior pilot, called Lieutenant Dubber. And a sub-lieutenant, Matley, who was also had been in an operational squadron. So really the three of us were old hands, as it were, and the rest, we had to train them up.
Old hands at the age of 25?
Yes, something like that, yes. And we had rather an unfortunate start with our deck landings. We went down to Norfolk, having done dummy deck landings day after day after day to prepare for this. And we went down, and the first four, I'd never been on the deck before in my life. I didn't let on to my pilots that I hadn't, because I thought that was rather bad thing. So I said, well, it's no trouble at all. And the first four of us went on quite satisfactorily. Then the next four, we had two barrier accidents. And this was on the USS Charger. And So the Americans were rather fed up with this. I think it was either two or three accidents we had. And they told us, we then got the orders to go back and do more dummy decks before we came on again. And I was summoned up to Washington to see Captain Evans, later Admiral Sir Charles Evans, who I'd known in Egypt. And he said, "What's all this about? What's gone wrong?" He said, "These accidents." I said, "I don't know, sir. We've done plenty of practice." He said, "Go away and send everybody on leave for 3 or 4 days, and then start again doing dummy deck landings, and then we'll put you on again." So I went back to have my leave. And next thing, we had orders to report on board HMS Smiter in New York for passage home. So they took all our aircraft, and we didn't land them on. We just were taken by transport. We flew them up to LaGuardia or somewhere, and they took them on from there. And then we flew them off when we got to the UK, and we went to RAF station at Ayr, and then we did our deck landings, did our dummy deck landings for about 2 days, and then we were appointed to the Formidable, and we never had another accident from that day onwards. Everybody landed on perfectly easily. I think, in a way, it was psychological, because the deck looked much longer. You had exactly the same landing space with 8 wires and a ninth. The ship looked so much bigger to land on. It may have been that, I don't know. But certainly we never had any further trouble at all.
What was it like being on the Formidable?
Well, I had a very great friend who was an observer called Bruce Hawkes, who was Little Wings, Lieutenant Commander. And so he gave me a great welcome. And we were the first squadron the ship had on her second commission. So she'd just done her sea trials again, and so they thought it was marvellous to have a squadron on board again. And very soon after that, they brought the Barracudas on board. I think we joined at about the middle of June, or end of June, and we sailed to do the Tirpitz operations on about the 14th or so of July, and we did our first attack on the Tirpitz on the 17th of July.
Can you describe that in detail, what you remember about?
Well, the fighters had two roles, really. The first was, of course, to escort the bombing force into the target. Tirpitz was lying about 60 miles inland, so there was no way you could get in there undetected. But the three ships, I think it was Furious, Indefatigable, and ourselves, I think it was Indefatigable, could have been Indom. we formed up very, very low, about under 200 feet when we took off. And then we circled around. Each carrier formed up either ahead or astern, depending on where she was in the formation. And then the air group leader in the Barracuda circled the fleet, and we all joined up, all below 200 feet, and we remained like that until we actually saw the coast. And then, of course, the barracudas had to gain height and fully loaded. It took them some time to get up to 10,000 feet. And meanwhile, the fighters were sort of weaving around above and below and behind to protect them against any enemy air attack, which didn't materialize. And then when we got to the target, they had already started the smoke canisters, which they had right round the field. And so you couldn't see the ship. We knew approximately where it was. And the Germans put up a box anti-aircraft barrage. So you had to fly through that box in order to get to the where we thought the ship was. So the barracudas did their bombing. In those days, out of my squadron of 18 Corsairs, we only had 6 which were equipped to carry bombs. So those 6 did a dive bombing attack. And the rest of us, just before the barracudas got to the target to go into the box barrage, we went forward and tried to strafe all the gun positions and try and keep the anti-aircraft fire down as much as possible. And so we were really sort of flying all around the area, shooting up anti-aircraft positions. And that on that day I lost my senior pilot, who was who landed on the water, and we saw that he was being picked up. He was very close to the shore, so we thought we pretty well knew he was going to be all right. And I think it was on either that day or the next day, I lost a New Zealander, and nobody saw him being shot down, so we don't know what happened to him. I think in all there must have been about 150 aircraft, maybe 130 aircraft from the 3 carriers. So it was a fairly sizable strike.
How much could you see as you went in to strafe the AA positions?
Oh, you could see they were all round. You see, the field was covered in smoke, but the AA positions were on the hills all around, so you could see pretty well. And we also had very good aerial photographs, which had been taken by the RAF. So we knew pretty well where these were. But it meant sort of flying down the barrels of the guns, more or less, which wasn't very pleasant. And we had, I think, almost everybody was hit somewhere by small arms fire.
Do you think you did much damage to the ACAC position?
Well, we hope we did. But I'm sure we did, but they still came the next day, and there was still plenty of fire about.
Did you see the men manning the ACAC positions?
Yes, I saw one of them in particular. I saw which I fired at, and I think I sort of dealt with them satisfactorily. Otherwise, the whole thing becomes rather confused. After you've done your first run at a target, then you have to pull up away in order to come down again, and you didn't quite know where you were after the first attack. So it was rather difficult to find the next target exactly. there were some destroyers out, about three destroyers, outside the smoke. And so we had a go at those with 0.5s, really. 0.5 gun on a destroyer is not very effective, but we tried to strafe the bridges and these ships. Then that went on for about 3 or 4 days. And I think after the first day, it was decided to send in the fireflies, which we didn't have on board our ship. I think they came from Victorious, or one of the other, Furious perhaps. And they went in with 500-pound bombs, very low all the way in. So they literally flew up the fjord at absolutely nil, 100 feet or so. And as they approached the target, they went up like this. And so they got in there, not entirely undetected, but they actually saw the Tirpitz, because the Germans hadn't got the smoke going in time. So they were the only people. I never saw a ship at all. They were the only people that didn't see it.
Which was more dangerous, attacking the Akak sites or attacking the destroyers?
I would say both equally dangerous. The only thing was that you could see, when you were taking the destroyer, you knew that they'd have anti-aircraft guns, and approximately where they were, it was on the land, you didn't really know. It was much more difficult to identify where they were.
What was the morale in the squadron before and after the attacks on the Tirpitz?
Oh, it was very high. We were sad that we'd lost our senior pilot, of course, but we knew he was being taken prisoner. And then the next in command, Subtent Matley, became senior pilot. And when we left the area, at about when we finished operations, and we all went and had a few drinks at the bar that evening, at about midnight we were turned out, and two Corsairs and two Avengers were ordered to take off, because we were apparently running into a force of submarines, and so the Avengers took off with depth charges, and the Corsairs took off really to protect them in case the submarines were on the surface, so it's, to strafe them. And the weather was absolutely terrible, the ceiling about 200 feet or so, and the Avengers took off first, and then myself and my senior pilot took off after them. And I was supposed to form up with the air group leader, a marvelous chap called Baker Faulkner, who had been on the April Tirpitz raids, successful Tirpitz raids. But I formed up with the wrong one, and so my senior pilot formed up with him, and I formed up with the other Avenger, and we did a